You are listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. The coronavirus pandemic, known as COVID-19, has raised anxieties around the world. How can we deal with anxiety in the age of coronavirus? Contributing host Lillian Ng explores. And first, the great promise of the internet to offer interconnectedness and the spread of great ideas has also brought great challenges in discerning fact from fiction. Our next guest discusses the ways that we can identify misinformation and disinformation. Damaso Reyes is a researcher, speaker, and trainer in the field of media and information. An experienced journalist, his specialties include providing professional development training for educators and journalists around the world, teaching them how to better understand the misinformation landscape and spot and fight against disinformation. Welcome, Damaso Reyes. It's great to have you here with us. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So I wanted to start about the scope of the problem today with false information, conspiracy theories, so-called fake news. Do we have kind of an idea in terms of maybe quantifying it or some way of understanding how bad it really is?
I think the scope of the problem is, let's step back for a moment and think about the scope of social media. Social media, as we know it, Facebook, Twitter, WhatsApp, didn't exist 20 years ago. That's how short the cycle and transformation has been. But Facebook now has over 2 billion active users. In just a very short amount of time, we've seen a pretty significant transformation in our lifetimes, in less than one generation. We've seen a transformation in how people access and communicate information in a pretty significant way around the world. So if you think about the amount of time that most of us spend online. In New Zealand, the figures that I've seen are something about 4 to 5 hours a day active online in some respect. So that's kind of the fertile ground when we talk about misinformation and disinformation. So from what we've seen and what we know, let's use the 2016 U.S. presidential cycle is an example, since for many people that's kind of the starting point of their awareness of the scope and extent of misinformation. We know about 30 million people shared, the vast majority of them unwittingly, some form of disinformation was created by the Internet Research Agency or another Russian proxy. So that's 30 million. Now, that's just the people who shared it. Now, obviously, when somebody shares something on Facebook, other people see it. So maybe 5, maybe 10, maybe 15, maybe 20, maybe 100 if it's a particularly popular post. So we know that, at least from that particular disinformation campaign, tens of millions, possibly hundreds of millions of people were exposed to misinformation or this particular brand of misinformation. And then when we look in our daily lives, when we sort of look at what becomes popular, what trends, we know that false information, misinformation spreads about 6 times faster than correct information. And it can reach the most popular misinformation posts on Facebook, for example, can reach up to 100,000 people. That's each post. So the scope of the problem is pretty significant. It's not everywhere all the time, but it's pretty insidious.
There are lots of different types of misinformation, video manipulation, sort of half-truths, fake profiles, bots, intimidation. How do you sort of categorize these? And is there sort of a sliding scale in terms of what to be most concerned about?
I think we should be concerned about all of it, in part because it all kind of pollutes the information ecosystem, right? Some of it is, very obvious and sometimes very scary. But what the goal of creating disinformation and misinformation is for a lot of the entities and agents and people who do it is to really erode our information ecosystem, erode our ability to communicate with each other, to have a civil discourse, to be able to know what to believe, to be able to trust in information. So all information or misinformation in that case is actually fairly dangerous. So we do have, very broadly speaking, a number of different categories. And one thing that I think it's really important to address early on is this concept or this term fake news. And we really want to retire it because it's become this kind of catch-all pejorative term that's kind of lost all meaning. So it's not particularly useful to talk about fake news since it's such a loaded term now. But we can talk about categories of misinformation and disinformation. So we have things like manipulated content. So when we see something, let's say a picture of a famous celebrity or athlete, and they're wearing a t-shirt which espouses a political cause that they never wore. That's an example of manipulated content. Some of the content is real, but it's been altered a little bit. We see fabricated content. We see things which are photoshopped completely. Deep fakes are an example of fabricated content. These are computer-generated videos of celebrities or famous people, and you know, they're saying things that they never said or doing things that they never did. We have things like false context. So we might have a photograph or a graphic that is real, it's not been altered, but the context in which it appears is false. So it seems to lend credibility to a false claim that we might see on Instagram or Twitter. So those are some of the many different kinds of misinformation, and they all have slightly different techniques, different tactics that they use to get at us. But underlying all of this is this idea that many of the people who create misinformation, they're trying to target our emotional centers. They're trying to trigger us emotionally. They're trying to make us fearful. They're trying to make us angry. They're trying to make us worried or concerned. And by doing so, they're hoping that they can override our ability to think critically. And then we just share the information. And that's how the misinformation propagates. And that's really what we're trying to combat and what we're most concerned about. We're trying to get people to take a pause, take a beat, think about whether or not what they're about to share is actually real. And if they have any question, any doubt, we want them to not share it, because then that prevents it from propagating.
Before we get into some of the ways people can identify what might be misinformation or disinformation, let's talk about the consequences. So you mentioned eroded trust and an eroded ecosystem of information, inability to communicate civilly. What other consequences do you see from the proliferation of, you know, I would argue even, you know, these repetitive conspiracy theories that seem to be circulating quite a bit these days? How do you see that?
So we have these, you know, what some people might call these kind of abstract consequences. So the erosion of social cohesion or civil discourse, these are, you know, very big words. But what we're increasingly seeing is direct, specific harm that's being caused either to individuals or to groups. And what happens is that people get exposed to a piece of bad information. They believe it. They make a poor decision, which leads to a dangerous action. In New Zealand and in the region, we've actually had a very recent example. Last year, there was an outbreak of measles in New Zealand, which in part was fostered by a spread of misinformation around vaccines and their efficacy and their risks associated with this. And in the United States, clearly we've been riding this way for quite some time, and it's spread all over the world now, unfortunately. And so vaccination rates declined over a course of years, and there was a measles outbreak. Now, fortunately, New Zealand has an excellent healthcare system, and fortunately, nobody died. But there were children and people who were sickened and put in danger. That's a real consequence. And tragically, that measles outbreak was then exported to Samoa, where I was last week. And they don't have the same kind of robust medical infrastructure, but unfortunately, they were also exposed to a lot of the same mis and disinformation around vaccines. And not just the misinformation, there was a series of events which led to a lowering, a quite rapid lowering of vaccination rates among young people and children. And tragically, over 80 people died last year, many of them young children, because they were infected with measles. And the truth is that measles is a very dangerous disease, especially if you're a young person, especially if you don't have the kind of robust supportive care you might find in a place like New Zealand or Auckland. So misinformation has real-world consequences. It can lead to people dying. Certainly in other parts of the world, we've seen in India and Pakistan, misinformation being used against ethnic minority groups, often being spread via WhatsApp or other social media. The trope is that a specific member of a social minority group has been seen or accused of committing some kind of sexual violence against the majority group woman or girl. And so then that spreads. People get together and they decide to attack or even murder that person. We've seen examples of this, many examples of this, unfortunately, over the past few years. So far from being theoretical, misinformation causes real-world harm that we can directly see and directly measure, and it seems to be increasing.
Ordinary people are pretty busy and have, you know, work and school and kids and all of these types of things. How can they know or identify or screen out misinformation?
So I think it's really important to actually challenge this idea a little bit, because I hear it a lot. And I think about my own social media habits and information gathering habits and those of the people I know. Oftentimes, I'll be at work during the middle of the day, and I'll see friends of mine posting lots of stuff on social media. And I'm thinking to myself, aren't you at work? The truth is, we actually have a lot of time. We spend a lot of time on social media. Question is, what do we think is a good use of our time, right? And so we haven't been socialized and we haven't been taught that verifying information, questioning information is actually a good use of our time. So there's a bit of behavior modification that I think needs to happen. We need to start thinking about the consequences of accidentally sharing misinformation and why we have a social responsibility to ensure that the information we share is real and is accurate. There are a couple of, you know, relatively simple techniques that we can use to, if not verify information, certainly help prevent the spread of misinformation. And so the first thing that we should do is when we come across a piece of information, we should ask ourselves, what's the source of this information? So is the person sharing it the person who created it? Or are they sharing something that somebody else has created or that somebody else is sharing? Can we figure out who the original person is who shared it? And what do we know about this person or this entity or this group? Are they transparent? Do we know who they are? Are they hiding? Are they anonymous? Once we figured out who shared it or who created it, what else do they share? Do they share a lot of things that seem like they might be conspiracy theories or seem like they might not make a lot of sense? That could be a sign that, you know what, this might be false information or this might be misinformation too. So maybe that's 5, 10, 15 seconds into the process, right? You know, we're getting maybe yellow lights, maybe not a red light yet. When I look at the information, do I have a strong emotional reaction to it? Am I angry? Am I sad? Am I fearful? Sort of disproportionately? Does it make me want to act? Does it make me want to share because I'm operating from a very emotional place? If that's the case, that's kind of a red flag that you may be being emotionally manipulated. And so you should really take a beat here, because accurate information, fact-based information, shouldn't be emotionally manipulative. You might sort of get intellectually concerned, or you might say, hey, there's some injustice happening here, but it shouldn't make you want to punch a wall or make you fearful for what's around the corner. And often misinformation is specifically trying to target our emotional centers in the hope of overriding our ability to think critically. And then we keep going, right? 30, 35 seconds in, we start asking ourselves, well, What are the claims that are being made by this piece of information? Do they offer any evidence, or are they just making an outrageous claim, right? Oftentimes we see misinformation. It makes a claim. It provides no sources, no evidence. So if something makes a claim and it provides no evidence, if it says something like 70% of highly intelligent people eat chocolate, according to whom? What's your source? Is there a study? Does anybody corroborate this? And if they do provide a link or do provide an evidence, well, that's an opportunity to look it up. You know, we're 45, 50 seconds in. Let's do a quick Google search. Does chocolate make you smarter? And let's see if we can actually find any standards-based sources which replicate this claim. So those are some of the very simple things. Again, in sort of less than a minute, we can, if not verify a claim, we can certainly see if more questions are raised. And if more questions are raised and we can't verify something, but maybe we can't totally debunk it, at that point, we should just say to ourselves, let's stop. Let's certainly not share it. By not sharing it, we've stopped the vector of transmission, and we've thwarted the people who are creating this misinformation. Because remember, the people who create misinformation proportionally to the people who are on social media are actually quite small. So they require ordinary people, unwitting hosts, let's say, if we want to use the medical example, to share this misinformation. That's the only way that it can propagate. Bots can't propagate misinformation nearly as effectively as ordinary people. And that's something that the data science is showing us quite well. They're the seeds and they often get something going, but it requires ordinary people in order for this misinformation to spread. So if we practice, internet or social media hygiene, we can actually stop this stuff from spreading.
So I noticed that there are some countries taking this on almost like a national project. Finland is one of them. What can we learn from places like Finland that are taking on teaching people while they're in school at a very young age what should be done to prevent sort of the widespread adaptation?
I think that what's great about these efforts is that we're seeing them take it extremely seriously. We're seeing countries begin to take this as a kind of national emergency, as seriously as making sure young people are vaccinated, or as seriously as they should be taking climate change. It really requires a fundamental rethinking of how we educate young people. And that rethinking has to be centered around critical thinking, not just absorbing information and being able to repeat it, you know, as many of us learned when we were in secondary school or primary school, but really be able to critically assess information, being able to find sources of information, being able to independently analyze information and interpret it for other people. And that's a different way of teaching than, you know, most of us learned in certainly in the 20th century. And it requires also retraining how we teach teachers. But this is how we're going to deal with this problem. It's not going to be a local municipality or even a province or a state. This really has to begin to be addressed on a national and a multinational level, because the problem doesn't respect borders. It doesn't respect language. You have, as we saw in 2016, young teenagers in Macedonia monetizing misinformation during the U.S. election cycle. So we need to start treating the problem as an international, certainly as a national level problem. And oftentimes it's national governments that have the weight and have the money to begin to demand these sorts of reforms and to support educators and parents as they begin to address this issue.
You know, you bring up another really important point, which is the monetizing of information and the sort of what we would call the political economy of media, including Facebook and Google and whatever, the Macedonians, that whole idea of making money from either informing or misinforming or getting people emotional. And I would say there's a big scale, sort of a long spectrum of how that is done. And today there's the people who try to get our emotions by misinformation or by mischaracterizing or giving a narrative, as you said, that might get people to pay attention. But there's also the problem of paywalls. And so it becomes harder and harder to get good journalism.
I'd push back on that just a little bit. First, even in the land of paywalls, we have more free access to information than at any time in human history, certainly in any time in recent memory. The vast majority of information is still free and still accessible, at least to a limited extent. Usually the problem is not that people are doing their diligent search and then they come up to a paywall and then they give up. That's not at least what I'm seeing. I don't know what other researchers and experts in the field are seeing. But what we do need to do and what we do need to acknowledge as a civil society is that journalists need to be paid. You know, journalists work incredibly hard and news organizations spend a lot of money verifying and doing this hard work. So how are we going to support that? There's an argument, perhaps, that some people might say that information wants to be free, that this sort of very important civic information needs to be free. Okay, if that's the case, how do we then support quality journalism? Are we asking the government to subsidize it? Are we asking philanthropists to subsidize it? I don't think there's any one model, but the truth is, whether it's in our everyday lives, getting a coffee, or the things we spend money on online, things like Netflix, people don't question whether or not they should pay for a Netflix or an iTunes subscription. They say, okay, well, I get value out of this. And I can't get this anywhere else unless you want a pirate or torrent, which the average person maybe doesn't have the technical skill or desire to do that. But they've sort of been after, you know, the Wild West days of the early internet where everything was free, people began to be accustomed to paying for entertainment. And now you have Apple TV and Netflix and Amazon Prime and all these things that are making significant amounts of money because every month people say, okay, I'll give you my €5 or my 10 New Zealand dollars or my $15 for Netflix because I'm getting something out of it, something I value. We have to, and I say we, and I'm a journalist, journalists need to make their case. We need to help the public understand that the information that we work so very hard to produce is worthy of paying for. And places like the New York Times have been very successful and made a lot of money doing that. But we haven't yet as a society changed our thinking, our behavior when it comes to news, that's worth paying for. We've largely done it when it comes to entertainment. And that shift has happened. But I think the next shift needs to be that we need to see this as a valuable resource.
So one of the things that has eroded over the last 30 years, particularly in the United States, where you're from, is trust in journalism. And that has come from other types of media organizations that have potentially an economic benefit by targeting standard traditional ethical journalism. And then when you add the paywall to it, and I'm certainly not arguing that there's not a cost to producing good journalism, but I'm talking about a general information ecosystem that you brought up at the very beginning. So it's kind of a perfect storm in some ways, wouldn't you think?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, what's important to recognize is that journalism organizations, specifically corporations, did a really, really lousy job of monetizing the internet in the first 10 or 15 years of the 21st century. They were giving away internet ads as part of a bundle if you bought a print ad. They were really devaluing their own product and also giving it away for free. So you're training the consumer to expect that this is free and to value it that way. So the media organizations and corporations have a lot of blame to bear. But this erosion of trust, you know, it comes from a couple different directions. First of all, there are actors, for lack of a better word, who their goal is to erode that trust because they have their own agenda, or they want you to trust them and not trust someone who will maybe expose what they're doing. So that's one thing. Politicians can be guilty of this. There are state actors who have been trying to do this for generations, not just recently. The other thing is, you know, over the past 30 years, there's just been a tremendous amount of competition in the information game. When I was a school-aged kid, if something called itself news, I could trust that it had been created by a journalist for the purpose of informing me and checked by an editor. Now I have no such assurance. Lots of people calling themselves journalists, lots of things calling itself news. There's just more information out there than I ever had to deal with as a kid. So it's not just an erosion of trust. There's just more choice out there. And of course, the challenge is those other forms of information are targeting our emotional centers. They're targeting our biases. They're tailoring information to what we want to hear, not necessarily what we need to hear. And it's really hard to compete against that. So do I want to eat my vegetables and learn about what's happening in the local city council meeting? Or do I want a funny meme or a funny joke video? If I don't know the value, the comparative value of those things, if I haven't been taught those things in school, yeah, of course I'm going to choose the candy. Certainly we have to begin to address socially and through education, the actual media landscape we live in. As adults, we're often teaching the way we were taught, which was for a very different kind of media landscape. And I think journalists obviously have a role. We have to be much more transparent in our work. We have to do much more around engagement. There are many of my colleagues, unfortunately, still think that, hey, we tell the truth, we're the authority, believe us, that's enough. Well, we're in a very competitive information market space, and as distasteful as I think it is for some older journalists and even some younger journalists, we have to make our case. And you know what? There's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with proving why we're trustworthy. There's nothing wrong with being transparent about how we do our work. If anything, it makes people more passionate about our work, and it makes us seem more trustworthy than the other people out there creating mis- and disinformation who aren't being transparent.
Well, Damaso Reyes, it's been a great pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much for joining us here.
Thank you for having me.
Damaso Reyes is a researcher, speaker, and trainer in the field of media and information literacy. When we come back, what are the psychological states of the novel coronavirus, and how do we respond to heightened anxiety and fear amid threat and uncertainty? Stay with us. You are listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Alongside the rapid spread of the novel coronavirus has been a rise in anxiety. What are the psychological states of COVID-19? How can we respond to fear and anxiety amid the threat and uncertainty? Lillian Ng, senior lecturer in medicine at the University of Auckland, discusses with Dr. Rob Sheaf.
I'm talking today with Rob Sheaf, who is a psychiatrist working in general adult psychiatry. He is a specialist in cognitive behavioral therapy and has a special interest in anxiety disorders. So today we're going to be talking about psychological states related to the threat of COVID-19. At this time, there's a lot of fear and anxiety about what's happening in the world, fear of becoming ill and in this pared back state and with life in a holding pattern. People feel very worried about how COVID will affect them and fearful. So can we speak a little bit about fear and anxiety? What are they and what is the difference between them?
Both fear and anxiety are widespread, they're universal, they affect every living organism, and they've been part of our experience as humans since day dot. We all feel fear, we all feel anxiety. It's a self-protective alarm system. It's what keeps us safe when we're faced with danger. But there is an important difference between fear and anxiety. Fear occurs when we are in the presence of something that's risky or dangerous. If there's a snake in my room at the moment, I'm very likely to demonstrate fear. Anxiety is the emotion that we feel in response to thinking about something that might be risky or dangerous in the future. So if I think that I might be going to a country where there might be snakes, I might become anxious about that. It's a worry, it's a thought process where we become apprehensive at the prospect that we might encounter something risky or dangerous that we wouldn't be able to keep ourselves safe from.
And I suppose in this lockdown state, there's a persistent fear, isn't there, or chronic apprehension, and people are scanning their environment and quite vigilant about the future. So it might cause us to be quite cautious or even avoidant in how we think about the future and how we act.
Well, absolutely. It's a period of enormous uncertainty. Again, there's a public awareness about illness and disease. We all know about diseases. We all know about infections. And added to that, there are so many sources of perhaps not particularly helpful information in movies, and there are endless computer games, board games about pandemics and infections, so it's all in our awareness. But despite that, it's a time of enormous uncertainty, and I think that's where a lot of our anxiety lives. Anxiety grows on doubt and uncertainty. As soon as we know what it is that we're dealing with, our anxiety does tend to reduce a little bit. It's like being terribly scared of the dark until you turn the lights on and realize either that there's nothing there to be scared of, or there's something in front of us that we need to take action either to run away from or to defend ourselves from. But as soon as we know what it is that we're dealing with, then the information that that generates does tend to shrink anxiety in a very helpful way.
And we know there is evidence about the psychological effects, say, from the SARS outbreak in the early 2000s. So people became unwell and they were anxious about getting a fever. They were anxious about the lethality of illness, and there's a sort of separation from loved ones. And we know people in our community have various responses depending on their situations. How does the body respond to anxiety? And how does that translate to the way we behave?
Anxiety just has an incredibly pervasive impact on our bodies. Every organ system that we have has a responsiveness to anxiety. But the more characteristic physical manifestations of anxiety would include experiences like an increase in heart rate or an increase in the forcefulness of our heartbeat. We tend to get a dry mouth. Our breathing tends to dysregulate. We can breathe too quickly or too shallowly. We can hold our breaths when we're anxious, but all of that tends to create a feeling of shortness of breath or tightness in our chest. Our muscles tense up when we're anxious, and that tends to make us trembly or shaky. We get sweaty. It affects our bladder and bowel. Oftentimes we need to empty our bowel, or we get a feeling that we have to go to the toilet to empty our bladder. When we start to breathe irregularly, it changes our perception. We tend to notice changes in visual perception. We get flashes and crinkles in our eyesight. Our vision gets distorted. We can feel lightheaded, as if we're going to faint, all of which are horrible. And what we tend to do when we feel anxious, either the emotion of anxiousness or the physical experience of anxiousness, we want to get away from it because it's unpleasant. And the characteristic behavioral response that happens when we get anxious is avoidance. And that goes back to, I think everybody's probably heard of Charles Darwin. He did some very original research into how humans behave when they feel anxious. And the characteristic responses are to fight something. If there's something in our environment that's making us anxious, we want to fight it to get rid of it, to freeze in the face of anxiety. Or the very common one is to flee. So fear, fight, and flee are the common behavioral responses. And these days, the things that we thing that we tend to do most is to try and avoid something that we're anxious of.
And just on thinking about the surge in arousal that comes from panicking and thinking about how that translates into perhaps some of the panic behaviours and the sensations of panic that people experience. I mean, people already are quite sleep deprived when they're anxious. And do you want to talk a little bit about what happens when people have that extreme state where they literally shut down?
Of panic? I think it's sometimes quite helpful to think about anxiety on a spectrum, or like a volume knob that goes from very little, if we were measuring a line that was, say, 0 to 10, very little anxiety, which would be down the 1 or 2, and we'd have words for that like feeling a bit fretful or a bit uneasy. And then as the dial increases, we have different words that would attach to that, like feeling worried or scared or frightened, terrified. Right at the top of the dial would be words like panic. And it's not that it's a different experience, it's the same experience, but the dial's turned up much higher. And the importance of that, really, I think, in terms of helping people with anxiousness, is that it's much, much easier to manage anxiety, to contain anxiety, if we're dealing with it when it's relatively low down on the scale. And that's true for anything. Pain is easier to deal with if it's not too strong. Sadness is. And anxiety, certainly, if we're good at noticing when we're getting a little bit anxious, it's much, much easier to put it out. It's a bit like a fire. It's much easier to stand on a little smolder than try and put out an out-of-control bushfire.
Can you explain a little bit about what happens to the brain and stress hormones when we're exposed to stimuli that evoke fear?
Because our basic need as organisms, I guess, humans or organisms, is to keep ourselves alive. And the thing that's going to most help to keep us alive is to keep away from things that are dangerous. So all our senses, our smell, sight, hearing, feelings on our skin, all tunes into our environment to look for signs of threat. So that when we perceive something, when we see something or hear something that's threatening, it goes directly into a very primitive part of our brain called our amygdala, which is a little almond-shaped bit deep inside our brain stem, which is a little bit like a threat detector. And if our amygdala gets information from our senses, and this happens in fractions of microseconds, it fires off a huge volley of chemical and electrical messages to important brain structures that mediate the fear response. And most of these happen deep down in our brainstem, well away from our cortex, which is our thinking brain. These are things that happen kind of subconsciously or away from our voluntary control. It hits directly into our breathing, our heart rate. It connects to our hormone system, and we get a flood of stress-mediating hormones. I guess the one we relate to or understand most commonly is a hormone called cortisol, which spikes very, very quickly with anxiousness. And it serves to gear our body up so that we can mobilize what we need to get ourselves out of harm's way.
And they're going into overdrive at the moment, I think, with a lot of the chronic stress that people are experiencing. You talked about some of those circuits and the hormonal response. It's the loss of daily routines that provide normality that produces all sorts of normal and abnormal emotional states. And can we talk about some of those?
Oh, I think you're absolutely right. I think I always sound a bit old-fashioned when I talk to people how important day routine is, but I just can never overestimate the importance of having structure in our lives. If our routine, if our environment's organized and structured and predictable, we tend to feel internally organized, structured, and predictable. If we live in chaos externally, we tend to feel chaotic inside. So one of the most important things for people to understand is the benefit that comes from making certain every day that their days are structured and they have a balance, so that from the time they get up to the time that they go to sleep, people know how they're going to be occupying their time, because psychological misery loves empty space. And if we create a lot of empty space, if there's a big vacuum in our time, then horrible thoughts and feelings are very likely to rush in and fill that up for us. So I think probably the single most important thing for people to do in these times is to make certain that their days have a blend of work of some sort. If people are in a position where they can work remotely from their homes, then work of some sort. But that would also include work around the house or safely in their garden, if that's possible. So some sort of productive, meaningful work every day, exercise every day within the limits of what the government tell us that what we're allowed to do, having social contact so we don't feel isolated from each other is crucial, but also making certain that we're doing things for peace and relaxation. It's a great opportunity. We've got a month or so where we can start to learn how to meditate or set up a yoga practice. And it's also crucial to have things to do every day that make us feel happy, if possible. Because unfortunately, part of the human condition, if we're left to our own devices, we tend to settle into a bit of a negative, pessimistic, kind of gloomy mood state. We have to work to keep ourselves happy. And if we're not doing things that make us feel happy, we tend not to feel happy. So it's really important that people have the opportunity to either foster things that they do for happiness, go back to things that they used to do previously for happiness, purely so that we've got activities every day that we can use to keep ourselves a little bit more positive and upbeat.
What developed that discussion about feelings as we talk about how we function as ultra social beings? Because normally we band together and that's a way of protecting each other and assisting one another. But you know, humans do need each other to survive and prosper. But there are some effects and risks of being isolated. Do you want to talk a little bit about those?
Being part of a group is enormously primitive and adaptive. Like you said, there's safety in numbers. There's safety in a group. We tend to fare much better if we're surrounded by people than if we're trying to get by in isolation. Keeping somebody in isolation is a time tested way of making them miserable. You know, solitary confinements are a hideous experience to inflict on somebody. We tend not to do particularly well if we're quarantined or isolated from other people. It links to just about every abnormal or unproductive maladaptive emotional state. We do best if we've got company.
Yes, and there are risks, aren't there, about loneliness, and a loneliness is in the literature which is akin to isolation, and people may feel in a state of grief, of sadness, or being bored or feeling lonely. I'm just also aware that loneliness in the literature has been associated with an increase in inflammatory markers, which actually decreases the immune response.
Well, it does, and that catches us in a nasty catch-22 situation where we're in the middle of a pandemic. We're doing whatever we can to keep away from infection. In order to be safe from infection, our immune system has to be in good functional state. But unfortunately, the more anxious we get, the more isolated we get, the more it tends to hit our immune system and the more vulnerable and susceptible we are to infection. So to keep ourselves fit and healthy and safe in these sort of times, it pays to look after our physical condition and our social distancing, but also to pay attention to our state of mind, because there's a very strong connection between our state of mind and our body defense system.
I just want to turn a little bit towards anxiety as a normal adaptive response to threat. How do you distinguish between what is normal and what is pathological?
I said before, anxiety is a normal reaction. There are a number of impacts of anxiety, though, that create a threshold between helpful anxiety that's going to keep you safe and unhelpful anxiety that entirely destroys the quality of your life. The first is distress. The more distressed we feel by our anxiety, the less helpful it becomes. And that's often a function of intensity. So the more intense anxiety becomes, the more distressing it becomes, and the more distressing it is, the less adaptive it is. And the other thing that happens with anxiety is the connection between a level of anxiety and our ability to perform. We all need a degree of anxiety to be able to perform well. Sports people, for instance, rely on a degree of pre-competition anxiousness to put them in a situation where they're going to be in their peak performance. As anxiety increases, our performance tends to increase and then plateau. But if we go beyond that in terms of a level of anxiety, our performance deteriorates and our ability to function falls off. So that's the other important factor that I would consider to differentiate ordinary anxiety from unhelpful anxiety. The first is the amount of distress that it makes us feel, and the second is the degree of impairment that it creates in our ability to function.
You talked earlier a little bit about chronic stress and the effects on the body, but what are the effects of chronic stress on the mind and body for that matter?
Persistent and sustained levels of emotional discomfort, whether it's sadness or anxiousness, very definitely has an adverse impact on our physiological state. There's a very strong connection, for instance, between depression, which is very closely related to anxiety, and loss of brain structure and function. Similarly, sustained anxiety, through the impact that it has on largely on our brain, on our body hormone system, which is largely mediated by cortisol, does tend to have a sustained negative impact on our body functioning. It increases the risk of conditions like high blood pressure, heart disease, diabetes. It's a very, very long list of chronic physical health conditions that are very closely connected to sustained stress.
We do make responses and make choices which are psychological. Some of those choices are quite adaptive and some of them are not so healthy. Can you talk a little bit about what ways people use to cope with stress, both acute and chronic, that are healthy and unhealthy?
Stress management and coping with stress, there are some general ideas and some universal ideas, but we're all wired up a little bit differently. And what helps to calm one person down may drive another person completely mad. But the general stress containers would be things like regular exercise, social contact, communicating about thoughts and feelings, distraction. Meditation is a very strong form of stress reliever. Some people would use things like humor to relieve stress. Making certain that we have sufficient good quality sleep is fundamentally important to relieving stress. Less helpful ways of dealing with stress, like you said, oftentimes come down to choices. And some of the choices that we make about the behaviors that we use aren't particularly adaptive in terms of stress. For instance, we might choose to spend a lot of time online as a stress reliever. And while there's a lot of material online that's phenomenally helpful in terms of providing us with information, and there's an awful lot that we can read that's full of fear and unfortunately misinformation. So being careful about what we expose ourselves to online is important. we need to make important, helpful choices about what we eat and drink. A lot of people use food as a way of managing their stress. With being relatively confined for at least the next 3 or 4 weeks, it is important that we make careful, sensible choices with our food. Alcohol, obviously, people use as a way of containing stress. I think it's very important to bear in mind the guidelines in regard to healthy and safe drinking and do what we can to try and stay within those.
In the face of the future being so uncertain, one of the things that we do default to are irrational thoughts. For example, that the supermarket's going to run out of food. So it seems that training the mind is as important as training the body. And one of the tools that we have that has an effective evidence-based in treating anxiety is cognitive behavioural therapy. Can you explain what that is and how it works?
Cognitive therapy, particularly as it applies to anxiety, relates to the idea that it's not so much the things that we're dealing with that make us feel anxious, but the way that we think about them. And generally, when we are anxious in our thoughts, we tend to be thinking about something that's in the future, and we tend to be thinking about that thing in a particular way. Specifically, we tend to focus our attention on how risky and dangerous something is, and at the same time, we focus our attention on how unlikely we are to be able to manage that perceived threat. So there's a gap between thinking about something in the future as a risk that we're not going to be able to deal with. And the bigger that gap, the more anxious we tend to get. So, for instance, I'm terrified of the dentist. The more I think about how dreadful the dentist is going to be and the less able I am to keep myself safe, the more anxious I'm going to feel. If I can shrink down that gap by shrinking down how likely and how risky something is in the future, and if I think carefully about what I can do to be better prepared for that risk, I'll feel progressively less and less anxious. And if I can flip that so that I start to think that actually the future isn't too risky, and even if it was, I'm well prepared to deal with it, I'm going to feel confident rather than feeling anxious. So part of that involves having good, accurate information about how risky the future is. And a significant part of it is doing what we can to be resourceful and resilient so that we can back ourselves to be able to deal appropriately with dangerous things if they actually eventuate. Because we all know that a lot of the stuff that we worry about will never happen. But you can't rely on that because we equally know that bad stuff does happen. You can't stick your head in the sand and pretend that everything's going to be fine because unfortunately for some of us it won't be. But we don't do ourselves any favours if we unnecessarily inflate the degree of risk in the future. And one example of that that I've heard a lot of people talking about with a lot of anxiety is the awful devastation that happened through the Spanish flu. And a lot of people are drawing a line of similarity between the coronavirus outbreak and the Spanish flu pandemic. And certainly the Spanish flu pandemic was a global catastrophe that killed somewhere between 40 and 50 million people. And we all focus on that, and it's terribly, terribly scary. But the important thing to bit of information to have that might relieve some of that anxiety is knowing that the Spanish flu happened in 1918, and a large proportion of people who died from the Spanish flu actually died from secondary bacterial pneumonia. And the important bit of information that a lot of people need to know is that antibiotics weren't discovered until 1928. So a huge number of people who died from Spanish flu died from a condition which, with modern antibiotic medication, is treatable. So a little bit of information can go an awful long way to rectify the imbalance in our thoughts when it comes to accurately determining how risky and dangerous something is. And without doubt, the coronavirus is a global threat, but we need to be careful that we're understanding accurately the extent of that effect so that we don't become caught up in what I've seen a lot, which is very counterproductive hysteria.
I mean, you've given a lot of advice already, very practical advice on coping. But are there any particular resources that you'd recommend to help people who are having difficulty dealing with their emotions and the effects of isolation?
Well, I think a universal, most important and accessible resource is talking to other people. I think if we can share our experiences with other people, if we can tap into their wisdom and experience and expertise, it's massively beneficial. Beyond that, there's a deluge of available how to deal with anxiety and stress options. There is a very well put together web page called CALM, which is an acronym for Computer Assisted Learning for the Mind. There are a number of smartphone apps that are well-researched and effective tools to help people deal with anxiety. One of them is called Headspace, which is a very, very straightforward, easy to follow step-by-step training program using technique based on mindfulness-based meditation to relieve anxiousness. There's another very helpful smartphone app called Insight Timer, which is a huge library of guided meditations that can be enormously beneficial. Added to that, there are two or three very helpful books. One that I very commonly recommend is written by a British research psychologist. His name is Mark Williams, and the name of the book is simply called Mindfulness. Another book, it's written by Edmund Bourne. It's called The Anxiety and Phobia Workbook. There's a book that is written by Dennis Greenberger and Christine Podesky called Mind Over Mood, which is a very well-structured kind of do-it-yourself cognitive behavioral therapy program that has huge applicability to managing anxiety and worry.
So thank you, Rob, for sharing your expertise and for your time to talk about psychological and emotional states in this time.
Thank you for asking me to join you, Will.
And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible.
To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.